I next met with Dr. Leisha Sequist, and to begin, we chatted about a publication from the New England Journal which she co-authored, Case Records of the Massachusetts General Hospital, focusing on a 55-year-old man with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer who, after beginning chemotherapy, was discovered to have an EGFR tumor mutation.
Well, it's such a common situation that we find ourselves in. I think the real lesson of the IPASS trial, which was published in the New England Journal in 2009, was that you shouldn't guess about the mutation testing. Yes, a treatment like gefitinib or erlotinib makes a lot of sense in the front line if you know you have an EGFR mutation, but practically, you often don't know whether or not you have an EGFR mutation when the patient comes in for their initial consult. What I try and do is if the patient is stable and willing to wait for the mutation test to come back a couple of weeks, we try and wait so we can have all the information before making a treatment decision. But the number of patients who are able and or willing to wait, you know, is small. Many times patients are very anxious, want to get going with something, or they're very symptomatic and you really don't think medically it's the right thing to do to wait on treatment. So in that case, if you don't know, you should start with chemotherapy. But commonly we then find ourselves in this position where we've given one or two cycles of chemo and then you get an EGFR mutation test that comes back. And I get a lot of emails about this. Should I stop the chemo and just switch to erlotinib? Should I add erlotinib into chemo or keep going with chemo? And I think there's no cookie cutter answer that fits every patient. The factors I take into consideration are how is the patient doing on chemo? Is it fairly tolerable? Are they having horrible side effects? Do you know if their cancer is responding to the chemo? Have they had restaging or has a symptom that they presented with gotten better? If they are tolerating chemo well, and especially if it seems like they may be responding to chemo, I wouldn't rush to jump off of the chemo boat because, you know, lung cancer, it is a tough disease, even with these exciting advances about the genotype therapy. And if you're getting a response, that's not something to just poo-poo. So I think if someone is responding, I would stick on the chemo for four cycles and then switch over to erlotinib.
And you mentioned the issue of a patient who's very ill with symptoms from the disease. Now, if you know that the patient does have an EGF mutation, are you still going to go with an EGFR TKI in the sick patient, or would you think more about chemo?
If I know they have a mutation, I would definitely go for something like erlotinib, even if they're sick, performance status of 3 or worse. Although the traditional teaching with chemo has been that there's not really a benefit for poor performance status patients, I don't think the same holds with genotype-directed therapy. And there was even a trial done in Asia specifically of poor performance status patients with EGFR mutations, and they did very well. I think the trial in that case used gefitinib, but they did very well with gefitinib.
So in that regard, as long as we're talking about EGFR mutation-positive lung cancer, you brought a case today that really reflects, I think, the most common question we get about non-small cell lung cancer in general and certainly about EGFR mutation positive disease is what to do with the patient who's had a good response to erlotinib and now is beginning to progress. Can you talk about what happened with a 62-year-old man?
Sure. So this is a man that I'm treating right now who is actually still in that position. We haven't done anything yet, but he's been on first-line erlotinib for about 10 months, had a great response, which then plateaued, as we typically see. And now his most recent scan showed a little bit of progression in one of his multiple lung nodules. And we're getting another scan very soon to see what the rate of progression is and if it's confined to that one area. There's so many things that are coming out in the research for this patient population. So again, I think this is evolving very rapidly. But I think some of the key themes for the community oncologist to know about an EGFR mutation patient with acquired resistance to erlotinib is that, one, getting a repeat biopsy is increasingly important for figuring out what the best treatment options are. Two, continuing the erlotinib beyond progression is also a new paradigm of treatment that's been shown to be very important because of the flare in the disease that can sometimes happen when you take off the erlotinib. And local treatment, such as radiation or occasionally even surgery, if the progression is confined to a local area.
We're going to talk in a little bit also about crizotinib, but just to sort of fast forward in general, do the principles you just stated in terms of rebiopsy, considering continuation of treatment with erlotinib, does that also apply to crizotinib?
It does. I think it's a general paradigm for any targeted therapy that has worked well, but then you start to get resistance.
So this man, he had a repeat biopsy?
So he has not had one yet, but we are looking at his next scan with an eye towards biopsying the spot that's growing. The reason why it's important to do these repeat biopsies is that you can try and determine what the mechanism of resistance is. At least half the time in EGFR disease, it's because of the resistance mutation T790M. But there are a lot of other mutations that can happen in the remaining half of patients. And then the other thing that can be very important is that we've seen repeatedly from multiple different centers that a small proportion, probably somewhere between 5 and 10% of these patients, will transform to small cell lung cancer. And that might be treated in a completely different way. This is small cell lung cancer that still has an EGFR mutation. So we try and do biopsies, and I recommend, you know, in the community, no matter where you are, that you should try and get a biopsy if it's feasible and safe.
So just to get a little bit better picture about what happened to this patient, how did he actually present? What kind of symptomatology, if any, did he have? And what happened while he was on erlotinib?
So this particular patient presented with hip pain, which turned out to be from a metastatic lesion. And he started off getting radiation to his hip because he had quite a lot of disease there. And while the radiation was going on, that was a good opportunity to do the EGFR mutation testing. Patients who need radiation up front, whether it's to a bony area, to the chest, or to the brain, I think that's one of the most straightforward situations. We were talking before about the decision to wait for the genetic testing or start chemo. If you're doing radiation, you have an automatic waiting period. So he was waiting. We found out he had an EGFR mutation. We started him on first-line erlotinib. You know, at that point, he had multiple, really innumerable lung nodules in both of his lungs, as well as several spots of bony disease, one of which had been radiated. He had a great response to the erlotinib. Many of the nodules in the lungs are no longer detectable, and then the larger ones are much smaller. Bone pain completely went away, and he still remains feeling very good. If we hadn't got the scan, you know, he would never have guessed that he might be having some cancer growth.
And he's a non-smoker?
He is a light smoker, a former smoker.
And what kinds of problems, if any, has he had with the erlotinib?
So he has had the usual problems, rash and diarrhea. He has not suffered from extreme side effects that have led to a dose reduction. But certainly it's pretty common to require a dose reduction, especially in patients with EGFR mutation. You know, there's nothing that would suggest that EGFR mutant patients metabolize the drug differently than an EGFR wild type patient. But clinically, we do see that they tend to have worse side effects. And I think this is probably just because they tend to be on the drug a longer time. If you're treating a wild type patient with second line or erlotinib, they're probably only going to be on treatment for, you know, 2 to 4 months at most. And I think that a lot of these skin toxicities especially really build up over time with prolonged exposure, which may explain why the EGFR mutants tend to have a harder time with prolonged therapy.
What do we know about dose response to EGFR TKIs in patients with mutations? Do you need the 150?
I don't think you need the 150, but of course everybody metabolizes the drug a little bit different. And so if they can tolerate 150, then I try and give 150. I know there are some docs who start at 100 and see how the side effects are and titrate up to 150 for their EGFR mutants. I start at 150. That's the approved dose. But certainly most EGFR mutants don't need that dose biologically. There's even a study of looking at 25 milligrams a day in EGFR mutants, and patients tend to remain under control. Those patients were included in the study because they couldn't really tolerate any other dose. So it's a retrospective description rather than a study per se.
What about the older patient? Is there an age where you sort of preemptively start with a lower dose?
I don't know if there's an age, but there definitely is a body size. I get worried personally when you have a real petite woman, especially if they're, say, 70 or older. But I think just, you know, the one-size-fits-all dosing isn't always correct.
Any sense? I've kind of been wondering whether or not there are patients out there maybe who are older in their 80s, 90s, who are being diagnosed with lung cancer and potentially maybe shuttled right to hospice without even getting tissue sometimes or without getting genotyping. Do we have any, I'm not sure whether the word has yet gotten out that there is an alternative to chemotherapy in some patients. Do you have any data on that, or do you have any sense about that?
I don't have any data, but I completely agree with your gut feeling that that does happen. I mean, I think there's a lot of leftover biases about lung cancer from, you know, really a generation ago when there were no effective treatments and that was the most humane thing to do. Things have changed so much, not only with these targeted therapies, but, you know, the chemotherapies, for example, pemetrexed is just a totally different type of chemotherapy than the old time platinum-based doublet. So I think anything that we can do as a community to get the word out that there are gentler and sometimes much more effective chemotherapies and targeted therapies available for lung cancer.
So I would think that in a community-based setting, this man at some point soon, I guess, might be looking at chemotherapy and possibly continuing the erlotinib, but what kinds of experimental options might be open to him, and what exactly are you thinking about for him?
So there are a number of clinical trials, and the exact menu changes every 6 months, looking at erlotinib resistance. There's a lot of trials for erlotinib resistance out there, and really every drug company that has a compound that might impact EGFR is looking at this group of patients. So I think that consideration of a clinical trial is one option. And the other option, in my mind, would be adding chemotherapy to the erlotinib. I think that stopping erlotinib and going to chemotherapy is no longer one of my favorite options unless they just absolutely are miserable from erlotinib side effects. As long as they're at least tolerating the erlotinib, I would try and keep it going. And again, the reason for that is that about 25% of patients will have a really significant disease flare when you stop the erlotinib, and sometimes this can even lead to death. And this is first published by the Memorial Group, but I've now seen it many times. And that doesn't happen if you continue the erlotinib and keep the chemotherapy with it. Most of our standard lung cancer chemotherapies mix very well with erlotinib, and this has been shown in a number of studies, like the old Tribute and Talent studies, for example, mix chemotherapy together with erlotinib, and patients do quite well and are not at risk for a flare.
So another issue would be potentially a trial that might involve some of the newer EGFR TKIs, and I see that you've been very involved with one, afatinib, as well as another one, I have a hard time pronouncing, dacanitinib. Can you talk a little bit about what we know about these agents and how they're being studied right now?
There's three generations of EGFR inhibitors at this time. So the first generation is the gefitinib and erlotinib. They are both reversible drugs. So I explain it to patients that they bind onto the EGFR antenna or receptor, they bind like a strong magnet. So if you pull hard enough, you can pull it off. It's a tight bind, but it's not permanent. The second generation drugs are the ones that covalently bind to the receptor instead of being able to be competed out by ATP. So this is afatinib, which was formerly known as BIBW2992, and then dacanitinib, which was formerly known as PF299804. So these drugs are, you know, fairly similar to each other in the way that the two first generation drugs are similar to each other. They're both pan-HER inhibitors, so they also hit HER2 as well as EGFR, and they also bind very strongly. So, you know, one of the things that the second generation drugs seemed to be able to do in laboratory experiments was they seemed to be able to inhibit T790 very well. That's the most common resistance mutation to the first generation drugs. And I think in patients, I mean, there's still several studies going on, so we don't have the final word on this yet. But I think in general, people have been a little bit disheartened by how much activity has been seen or has not been seen in erlotinib-resistant patients with these second-generation drugs. And I think one of the main reasons for that is that because they have this covalent bind, they're stuck with superglue and not a magnet, that some of the side effects really can prohibit us from getting up to that dose needed to inhibit T790M. So these drugs in general have a little bit more rash and a little bit more diarrhea than the first-generation drugs. And they can work very, very well for naive patients, but maybe not quite as good as we had hoped for resistant patients. So now there's a third generation of compounds that are entering clinical trials, and the difference here is that these drugs do not hit wild-type EGFR. So they don't cause rash, they don't cause diarrhea, because they don't hit the EGFR in the non-cancer cells. They do hit activating mutations in EGFR, and they do hit T790M. So there's a whole series of third-generation drugs which are pretty much in phase one trials right now, but I think they will be exciting to watch the results come out over the next couple of years.
Maybe if you could comment a little bit on a trial that you were involved with, a phase three randomized study. Kind of reminds me a little bit of the IPASS study that was done with, I guess it was gefitinib, looking at chemo versus an EGFR TKI, in this case, afatinib, the so-called LUX-Lung-3 study. Can you talk a little bit about that study?
Sure. So as you mentioned with IPASS and some other studies like EURTEC, we've seen with both gefitinib and erlotinib that when you take EGFR mutation patients and you compare one of these first generation drugs compared to chemo cisplatin or carboplatin-based doublet, that patients tend to have a better PFS and in some cases better quality of life with the genotype-directed therapy. The LUX-Lung-3 trial is a similar design, two innovations on the design. One, it was a second-generation drug, so we're looking at afatinib, which is a pan-HER inhibitor. And the other thing is that it's the first of these types of trials to use pemetrexed. So pemetrexed has evolved to really become our favorite drug, at least in this country, for adenocarcinoma patients. And so we needed a randomized trial looking at an EGFR inhibitor compared to a PEM-based chemo. And patients got cisplatin pemetrexed for 6 cycles or afatinib daily on this trial. And the results of the trial showed that the progression-free survival was significantly improved with the afatinib, and the quality of life was also significantly improved.
Any way to indirectly compare what was seen there to what's been seen with, for example, erlotinib or gefitinib?
Sure, with the caveats of, comparing across trials. In the LUX-Lung-3, they did allow patients who had alternative mutations. So, the majority of patients would either have the two standard, either the exon 19 deletion or the L858R mutations, but there are about 15% of the trial cohort actually had atypical mutations as well, so they are less responsive to EGFR inhibitors. When you look at the whole population for LUX-Lung-3, the median progression-free survival was approximately 11 months. When you look at just the standard or classic mutations, the median progression-free survival in that group was 13.6 months with first-line afatinib. So you can compare that across trials with what's been seen with gefitinib in the IPASS study was 9.6 months, or erlotinib in the EURTEC study was in the 9-month range as well. So it seems like the second generation drugs like afatinib may give you a longer median progression-free survival by an order of 2 to 4 months. They haven't been compared head-to-head though, so.
So I guess the thing that got a lot of people's attention was the idea of combining an EGFR TKI, in this case it was afatinib, with an EGFR antibody, which in this case was ASCO now, I guess about a year and a half ago, was cetuximab. Where are we with that strategy?
So that strategy has been looked at. The initial trial expanded and expanded again, and I think the final number was they ended up having about 150 patients on that first trial, so it's a pretty big experience. The response rate turned out to be in the 40 to 45% range, so that's pretty good. I mean, that's better than anything else that's been looked at as far as targeted therapies go in erlotinib resistance.
And I guess it was seen with T790 mutations too.
It was. It was seen both with T790 mutations and without. And I think it's very exciting. I think where that regimen lies is kind of in the real world where you have to have, especially when the drugs aren't approved for lung cancer yet, you have to have someone behind it, like industry, who's willing to push it forward. And my understanding, I'm not directly involved with this regimen, but my understanding is that neither of the companies that make either of those compounds are willing to push it forward right now. Now, ECOG will be opening a study looking at afatinib cetuximab in patients who are resistant to erlotinib, and that'll be a larger randomized study. So I think that through the cooperative groups, we'll get some more answers about it, but it's not being pushed forward quickly. Afatinib may get FDA approved this year, and I don't know if that will change things or not.
This is interesting about the ECOG study. So what's the actual randomization?
So I believe that patients are randomized to afatinib alone or afatinib plus cetuximab. And then there's the option for crossover. So if you get afatinib alone, you can then add in cetuximab if that doesn't work for you.
I got to say, looking at the waterfall plot, and I know, you know, it's waterfall plots and whatever, it may not last that long, but I'm your patient, you know, I'm starting to feel sick. I'm thinking about that would look pretty good to me.
Absolutely. No, I agree. And the hardest obstacle, I think, with that regimen is the skin side effects. And as long as you're not having skin side effects, in fact, I was just talking to a patient of mine this weekend who is on that trial, has been on for almost a year. I referred her to another center that had that trial open because just like you, I thought, wow, that's a great waterfall plot. I should try and get this lady on that. And she's been doing well. She's about 11 months in.
But no major dermatologic problems?
She's definitely having dermatologic problems, but they're managing them with her. And I think our dermatology colleagues have really learned a lot about how to get on top of and prevent some of these EGFR-like side effects.
So another kind of common question that's been debated for a long time is the issue of the use of these agents and this strategy in the adjuvant setting. And of course, we don't have any real definitive data right now, but maybe you can comment a little bit on your SELECT trial that looked at this question and where we are right now in terms of cooperative group larger phase 3 studies.
So when you look at patients with advanced disease and you see the response rate with chemo is in the neighborhood of 30% and the response rate with TKIs is in the neighborhood of 75%, it seems like a no-brainer that if chemotherapy helps in the adjuvant setting, an EGFR TKI should help more. But I guess there are a lot of things in medicine that seem like a no-brainer until you test them out. So we did the SELECT trial, which was not a randomized study. It was a single-arm study of 100 patients who had resected lung cancer, known to have an EGFR mutation, and we treated them with 2 years of adjuvant erlotinib. The study's still ongoing, so we don't have the mature results. We did present last year at ASCO the fairly mature data for the first 36 patients in. It took a couple of years, several years, for us to get 100 patients. So by the time we were finishing up with number 100, the first 36 had good amount of follow-up. And what we saw from the first 36 patients was a very low rate of progression while patients were on the actual drug. I believe there was only one patient in that group that progressed while they were on erlotinib. We did see a handful of patients progress in the 6 months after stopping the adjuvant erlotinib. And, you know, that's something that we may see when we have the mature data on the 100 patients, is that, in fact, we're not necessarily curing these patients, but we are delaying the appearance or emergence of their metastatic disease. I think that in order to really see if there's a small group of patients who you're pushing over from recurrence to cure, you need a randomized study. And so together with NCI, the CLGB group is now working on a randomized trial where patients would get either placebo or erlotinib.
What's it like to try to get a patient through erlotinib for 2 years in the adjuvant setting?
It can be difficult for some people. I mean, I think it's different when you have a metastatic patient and you can show them a chest CT that's got a big tumor, and then a few months later, that tumor is a much smaller tumor. I think that really helps people psychologically manage the side effects. And when they have no measurable disease at the time they go on and nothing to follow on scans, it can be tough. It can definitely be tough. So we had about 30%, maybe even closer to 40% of patients did reduce the dose. And then we had another group of about 10% of patients who could not complete the 2 years. Either they dropped out after the first few months or they kind of set their own landmark, like, I can do this a year, but I can't do it 2 years.
So let's imagine that you've got a patient who's had a tumor resected who maybe happens to be a medical oncologist, so they're completely familiar with the literature and says to you, I understand that we need to wait for the phase 3 studies. But would you be willing to give me adjuvant treatment right now outside a trial setting?
I would be willing to give it. It's another question of whether their insurance company would be willing to pay for it. But especially if they have, you know, maybe a 1A, you might worry about the relative risks and benefits of doing that. But if you had a larger tumor, especially if you had lymph nodes involved, I would probably do it if it were me. We are actually opening another trial so that we don't have to be put in that position of fighting with insurance companies about it. And this trial is looking at adjuvant afatinib. for fully resected EGFR mutant patients. So that trial is going to be opening up at Mass General, at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and at Stanford University.
I guess one thing I've heard people say, and, you know, a lot of people are pretty conservative and don't want to do this almost in any circumstance, are concerned about the possibility of harm.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts about that?
Well, you have to take that into account, and I think you have to explain to patients what the risks of the drug are. You know, there is a small but consistent percentage of patients that will have a significant, even fatal complication from erlotinib, like interstitial lung disease. And, you know, that's a really horrible thing to happen in an adjuvant patient who may be cured from their cancer. As far as harm in terms of their chances of recurrence, you know, that is something that gets talked about as well after the Canadian group discussed at ASCO the results of their study with adjuvant gefitinib. And this was a trial that was done, you know, now a decade ago, and it was actually aborted early because of some negative results that came out about gefitinib in the metastatic setting around that time. But when they did the mature follow-up on those patients, even though the therapy was aborted early, it looked like there could potentially be harm from adjuvant TKI. Now, this was in all comers. It wasn't in the EGFR mutant population only, but they did have some patients with mutation status known, and it looked like even among those patients, there could be some harm. We haven't seen any suggestion of that from our SELECT data, but again, this is not a randomized study. You know, this is comparing to historical outcomes. So I think we don't know all the answers yet, but if it was a physician, or, you know, a more realistic question is, I guess if it were me, I would probably do adjuvant or erlotinib.
So another thing I want to ask you about, you mentioned that there's a trial about to begin looking at afatinib in the adjuvant setting, which I think is really going to be interesting. Any speculations there? You mentioned the thought that maybe these irreversible TKIs are more toxic in terms of what you think you might see in the adjuvant situation with afatinib.
So the dose that is projected to be FDA approved for treating metastatic patients with afatinib is 40 milligrams. And in this adjuvant study, we're actually going to start patients at 30 milligrams because of concerns about long-term tolerability. And because with erlotinib, we saw that, you know, a portion, about 10% of our patients dropped out of the study because of side effects. So to try and keep 10% of patients, those 10% in this study, we are going to start at 30 milligrams. And then if they're tolerating it, they could go up to 40. And if otherwise, 30 may be a good dose for them. We're also looking at a shorter course versus a prolonged course to see if there is any difference, you know, as has been shown in the breast cancer data, with the longer you give the treatments, perhaps the better. These drugs have a lot more side effects in general than the aromatase inhibitors and tamoxifen. So I think it's not such an easy thing for lung cancer patients to take these long term.
Anything else in terms of EGFR mutations and TKIs that we haven't talked about you want to comment on?
I think it will be very interesting to see what happens in practice over the next year if afatinib does get FDA approved. It's, I think, expected that it will get FDA approved for first-line use in EGFR mutation patients. And then so for the first time, docs will have a choice of using erlotinib, which isn't really indicated for that set of patients, but has been used for several years, and this new kid on the block of afatinib.
What do you think you're going to do?
Well, I think I'll talk about it with patients. I do think, as we were mentioning before, that if you do the non-kosher thing of comparing across trials, that it looks like afatinib has a longer progression-free survival compared to erlotinib, but it also looks like it may have slightly more side effects. So I think we'll just have to talk it over with patients and probably individualize the choice, but always more choice is better for the patient. So to have other options, I think, is a good thing.
So let's talk a little bit about squamous cell, and I see you have a 59-year-old man here. Maybe we can begin by talking about his situation.
Yeah, so this is a guy who had a history of laryngeal cancer. He's a heavy smoker, had survived through laryngeal cancer and a local recurrence of that, but then had a little bit of hemoptysis one day and went to his doctor, got some tests, and at the end of all the tests actually had advanced squamous cell lung cancer with a fairly large central tumor and mets to the other lung as well as to a couple of bony locations. So we did actually genetic testing on him. As I was mentioning, we do it on squamous patients as well as non-squamous patients, but no mutations showed up, including no FGFR amplification. So I treated him with first-line carboplatin and paclitaxel, And he just recently finished up four cycles. He was very gung-ho. He's a funny guy and very enthusiastic, just a joy to take care of. But when we started and explained that we would probably do four cycles, maybe push it to six, he was all about six. He wanted the max. He was going to go for six. But after the second chemo, he was pretty worn down. And after the third, he was even more worn down. And so the thought of going past four for him was just not feasible because he was starting to have a lot of fatigue, getting pretty dehydrated, needing to come in for IV fluid between treatments, and was really worn down from chemo. So we settled at four treatments, and he had had staging scans after both the second and the fourth cycle, which showed essentially stable disease. I mean, nothing that you could really say was a response, but also no clear progression. So pretty stable disease. And then we were trying to figure out about whether to consider maintenance therapy for him or go with a break from treatment.
So what kind of maintenance?
So for squamous patients, really the only FDA-indicated maintenance would be erlotinib. Pemetrexed is not recommended for squamous patients. There's also the concept of docetaxel from the FIDES trial. So that's an option. And I guess you could maybe think about extending the concepts from some of these other treatments with continuation maintenance. You could think about continuing the paclitaxel and dropping the carbo out, although that hasn't been well studied. So for him, I think personally, I'm not all that enthusiastic about erlotinib maintenance. I think that the Saturn study, which looked at the benefit of this, was a positive study. It was statistically positive with a good p-value. But as far as clinical significance, I think the 1 month of benefit that it showed for overall survival is not a hugely meaningful difference. And so unless they have an EGFR mutation, I'm not usually enthusiastic about erlotinib maintenance. And for him, continuing on with cytotoxic chemo when he was so beat up just didn't seem like the right thing to do. But I did talk to him about that this is sometimes what we do. It's a way to make sure that we get a second-line chemotherapy into some people. But I think that if we closely monitor people, we can also get in second-line treatment if needed.
Any comments about what we know up to this point about checkpoint inhibition with lung cancer? And particularly, again, to me, it seemed pretty interesting the fact that they seem like they saw pretty good results, including in squamous cell.
Yes, I think that there consistently have been about 15 to 20% of patients who have responded to this treatment. Now it looks like maybe the way to select out who those patients are going to be is by looking at PD-1 ligand expression. And I've actually had a lot of patients emailing me ask where they can get PD-1 ligand expression testing done on their cancer. And I don't know that that many places have it available as a clinical test. A lot of the trials will require that testing as part of a trial, but it's not readily available commercially, although I suspect within 6 months it will be.
And I guess I'm not sure it's that 100% predictive either at this point. Do you have trials yourself that you can put your patients on or places to send them where they can get anti-PD-1?
We do. We have a couple of trials open, and then there are several other on the East Coast that I've sent people for. What's amazing is that I think these are so hot and there's so much buzz about them that a lot of times these trials will only be open for 4 or 6 weeks, and then all the slots are closed. So it's largely a matter of timing. If you have a patient that's going to need that second-line therapy right in that magic window, it's a great opportunity. But it speaks to the need out there for more lung cancer studies. And any makers of exciting drugs, PD-1 or otherwise, that are listening to this, more trials are needed, bigger trials. There's lots of patients.
Yeah, unfortunately. Let's finish out by talking about your 41-year-old man who developed a recurrence of an adenocarcinoma in the lung after having had chemo radiation therapy.
So this is a young man who presented with feeling kind of a wheezing sound in his chest when he lay down at night and turned out to have a tumor in his left lung somewhat near his heart, as well as multiple mediastinal lymph nodes and also a supraclav node. So he was stage 3B, you know, even though he was 41 and we tried to think of a way where we could try and resect him for cure or something like that, it just didn't make sense with the positive supraclav node. So we did not consider surgery. We treated him with EP50-50 chemotherapy and radiation. And he responded well to that. Some scans done shortly after the chemo radiation showed a good response.
He was genotyped?
He was genotyped, and he had nothing. We tested him for EGFR, for ALK, for ROS. We even tested him for RET and HER2 mutations and MET, everything we could think of. Everything was wild type. It was frustrating. He had a pretty mild smoking history, you know, 5 years in college or something like that, but nothing turned up on his genotyping. So we treated him with EP5050 and radiation, 2 more cycles of EP after that, and his first set of scans looked good, but unfortunately his second set of scans, about 6 months after finishing up everything, already showed a little bit of growth, not in the areas that had been radiated, but actually he had multiple tiny pulmonary nodules, and you know, they were too small to say for sure if they were cancer, but everyone was certainly worried. So we gave him some antibiotics and, you know, tried to make sure that there was nothing else this could be, and rescanned him about 6 weeks later, and the spots were all bigger. So really worrisome for recurrent disease. So because he had no specific genotype, I talked to him about first-line chemotherapy. The spot that had been radiated actually still was under control. It was just there with all these other new spots growing up. So we talked about carboplatin and pemetrexed and bevacizumab. Actually, this particular patient was very interested in alternative medicine and wanted to forego that and do some, I don't know the details of what he wanted to do, but he wanted to go to Mexico for some sort of heated treatment. And that was a really challenging discussion to have with him because, you know, here's a young guy, he's got 2 little kids, not even in kindergarten yet. And, you know, if I'm honest with myself, I don't really have anything that can cure him. So we just had to talk about his priorities and his desires and beliefs. And we ultimately, he was completely asymptomatic from his disease. He had these tiny nodules. We decided to let him take a shot at what he had researched and what he felt very strongly about trying, and to see him again in a few months.
So that's his current situation?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. You know, I was kind of, when I saw that case, I was thinking, oh, you're going to tell me that he had an EGFR mutation, now you treat him, et cetera, et cetera. But, and I'm sorry that's not the case, but I am curious, though, about the strategy that I think is going to be tested of using pre-chemo radiation treatment with mutation-targeted therapy, EGFR mutations targeted with EGFR TKIs and crizotinib with ALK and ROS1. To me, it seems like it makes a lot of sense to debulk these patients first. Are those trials going forward, and what do you think about them?
So I think one of the biggest hurdles for trials like that is this SWOG study that Karen Kelly published 5 or 6 years ago now, the SWOG-0023, where, again, this was in the era before EGFR mutations were known to exist. So it was just all lung cancer patients, but they were treated with EP5050 and radiation. And at that time, they got docetaxel chemo as well. And then they got randomized after that to a sort of a maintenance strategy, which afitinib or a placebo. And when they looked at the results of the study, the gefitinib patients did worse than the placebo. So there definitely is this concern about why is that? It's never been well answered in my mind why that happened and how many EGFR mutants were on that study. But people are a little bit scared, I would say, of adding that into the mix of chemo radiation. But you're right, I think it will happen. And I believe that there's a intergroup study looking at that, or at least being planned to look at chemo radiation and erlotinib in known EGFR mutants.
I mean, you would expect most of these patients will have, you know, a response. It should make the radiation, you know, a little bit easier theoretically, I guess.
You're right. And I think doing it before the chemo radiation to try and narrow your radiation field is an interesting strategy.